Good evening, good evening. I have something for you before, remind me before you leave, I have something for you. Thank you very much. So she doesn't say anything to her husband. She locks the door so nobody knows about the boy being dead. It's not really clear why she... I have to tell you, there's a lot in Alicia's stories coming up which are just totally unclear to me. They're, miracles are flying fast and furious. Many of them have reference to Sefer Bereishit. I'll point them out as we go. But by and large, it's hard to say exactly what's being added from a moral standpoint. There's Malachim is about the success or the failure of kings. And again, as I said, this is really, people call this Megillat Elisha, because it's really not about kings, it's about Elisha being a miracle man. And the Christians love this stuff, right? They love this stuff. Elisha is their guy. He's a template. Oh, wait, he's about to take food and make it a little bit of food, feed a lot of people. I mean, you know where those stories wound up. So essentially, some of it is very unclear to me. That's my fault. I could probably make a deeper study of it and then try to find connections to other parts of Tanakh. But the best I could do is, at this point, is just to clarify as much of the stories as I can and then try to evaluate them. But there's things hidden here which I just don't see. So why she says, you know, peace to her husband when things are not peaceful, why she doesn't tell her husband, hey, the kid's dead, I'm going to run to Elisha, what difference did it make? And why does she lock her door so nobody would know? You could say it's a quantum. I mean, if I wanted to be scientific, I could say it's a quantum theory, which is a particle exists in two places until you look at it. The minute you look at it, so you define. It could be the boy was dead, but he wasn't really dead until somebody, the coroner, came in and said, he's dead. So it's as if you keep in the room all locked up and nobody could see.
Well, the psoriasis works like that, doesn't it?
I guess.
It's
I don't,
not really Sarad until the Kohen says it is.
I suppose
that's
so.
That's how you get everything out of the house.
Until it's comatose.
What's that?
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's something there's something more mystical going on. Now the Radak will talk about these issues. A lot of your Pshat Mefarshim will talk about the fact that he wasn't really dead, which reminds me of a wonderful scene in The Princess Bride. Anybody see The Princess Bride? And they bring in Wesley. Wesley has been, you know, tortured to death, and they bring him in, the swordsman, and Inigo Montoya, and the giant. And they give him to Miracle Max, who's played by the guy who was in When Harry Met Sally. What's his name? The Jewish actor who was in the...
Billy Crystal,
yeah. And they say to him, he's dead. And he goes, he's not all the way dead. He's just mostly dead. There's a big difference between all the way dead and... With all the way dead, there's nothing to do. But with mostly dead, so it's a very funny routine. I don't know whether there's something like that going on.
It was a thing like when... If a person was comatose or something... Maybe they weren't so knowledgeable as to what...
Right, correct.
Yeah.
Although...
There was a feather...
Right.
The dead ringer. They had a bell going down into the casket in case
No, is that where the word comes from? Yeah. I did not know. That's very interesting. Just in case, huh? Now we're in this. It's an interesting conflict here because, on the one hand, we believe in miracles. If we don't believe in miracles, it'd be hard to have a Pesach Seder. On the other hand, we don't want to get too carried away with miracles. There is no reason to invent a miracle that's not explicitly laid out in the Tanakh. And that's an interesting principle that Ibn Ezra brings down. There's a famous medrash about how God spoke Shamor and Zachor at the same time. And Ibn Ezra says, that's a big miracle. And if you got a big miracle like that, it would show up in the Torah. If you don't have the miracle stated in the Torah, then it didn't happen. And any drash which tells you that a miracle happened is simply that, simply a drash not to be understood at face value. So this is Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra is very cautious and says, if there was a miracle, it would show up. If it doesn't show up, it's not a miracle. And there's this tendency to find certain things in the Torah which are not, you know, miraculous. I think the Radak puts it very well.
They talk about the 50 miracles of the Red Sea and 200 miracles.
Correct, but the Radak would tell you something very simple. That's a midrash. It's trying to tell you the glory of God, or maybe you're just supposed to practice your arithmetics during the Seder. You know, otherwise the Seder is too heavy on English, on literature, so you want to do a little math. So you got 50 times 20, and you got the whole thing. It's what Menachem Leibtag calls the math section of the Pesach Seder. So Ibn Ezra would certainly call that midrashic, not to be understood literally. And the truth is, that's one of the easier midrashim, in my opinion, to interpret. That just means that God, the splitting of the sea and the fire that kept apart the forces of Egypt and the forces of Israel, was in a sense more powerful and more meaningful than what had even happened in Mitzrayim. And that could be easily the point of the Medrash, and then you don't have to believe that Chazal were telling you that there were actual miracles taking place, but they were telling you there were like miracles taking place in a metaphoric way. Eben Ezra simply goes with a very logical idea. We believe in miracles, but miracles are important, and if they happen, they should be in here. And if they're not in here, you're not going to make them up from the literal sense. You could play in a midrashic sense, but you can't make them literal sense. Here, the Radak comments something very interesting, because the Radak is, it's not just a nervousness on our parts to not be sure whether there's a miracle or whether it's just nature. Radak says, let me find it, Dalid, where are we, Chaf, it's already, well, we'll get to it when he starts breathing in his mouth. Where is that? It's in Pasuk, he breathes in his mouth, Pasuk, when he lays on the boy, that's verse 34, Pasuk Lamed Dalid. So I'll just read to you what the Radak says on it. Vayal, this is Elisha, he went up on him, Vayishkav al ha-yelid, he lays down the yelid, Vayasen piv al piv, he puts mouth on mouth, Ve'inav al einav, and eyes on eyes, Ve'kapav al kapav, Vayigar alav, now exactly not clear what Vayigar, but let's assume that he, I don't know, breathes into him perhaps, or he lays on, it's hard to say exactly what Yigar is, we'll get to it more later, Vayacham sar yelid, so everybody's probably, everybody who knows anything about modern science is thinking, oh, that's CPR. Although it doesn't match up with the eyes and the hands, but okay, CPR. So the Radak, on one hand, leads you away from that. While on the other hand, he says like this, Kemosha Pirashnu Be'Eliyahu. I explained this back on Eliyahu, and he resurrected the boy. Now, he doesn't tell you what he explained. You have to sort of go back and look, but who's going to say it now? Shamar Vayit Modeid Al Anar. That is, he aligned himself, he measured himself to the boy. Vakol L'Chivan Lashon HaTefilah. All of it has to do with prayer. That is, the whole action of laying out, he's steering us away from the physical and telling us that it has to do with, like, sort of, he's going to explain in the terms of a proxy. That is, because Elisha was praying for the boy, he sort of mimicked the boy's position as if the prayers would sort of come through Elisha to the boy. It's miraculous. Al-Mashim Palelov Kamosha Amar B'Yitzchak L'Nochach Ashto Yishto. Yitzchak prayed sort of in the face of or against his wife. He was praying for his wife. But he stood next to her to sort of at a channel, if you will, for the prophetic abilities. The Efshar Gamkein, it is also possible, says the Radak, Lahanshim al Hanar Lachamamo, that he was breathing into the child to warm him up, which is a more physical. See, Radak's giving you both ways. You could sense his, not exactly discomfort, but there's two ways to call it. And then he says like this, Bechom Hativi, with natural heat, the natural remedy, if you will. Hayotse mipiv umeinav. So why eye to eye? Because there's, I don't know, perhaps a certain heat or warmth that's coming out of the eyes as well. Kirov hanisim, because most miracles, nasim im ma'at tachbula miderech haolam. They happen with some connection or with some spark plug from the natural, some tie from the natural world. So you can see it's not just a new idea that when we see a miracle, we're saying, well, how did that happen? And maybe it was there was a natural essence to it. The question is, does that reduce
the miracle?
And I think what Radak wants to do is make us feel not. I think what Radak wants us to feel is, if you want to believe it was all miracle prayer, go for it. You got no problems. If you feel that it looks like a very physical thing, the aligning of the mouth and the hands and the eyes, don't be so worried. Don't feel like it's going to minimize the miracle, because most miracles, it's the way of miracles to be jump-started with Derech HaTeva, with natural events. And of course, the most original one would be Kriyat Yamsuf. I always speak about this. God made the wind blow all night, Beruach Kadim Azah, and then the Yamsuf split. I said God needed a big wind. God could have, you know, snapped his fingers, Kiviyachol, or made it. He didn't need a whole night of blowing. It could be that simply that God prefers, for whatever reason, to make sure that miracles happen in a way that could be explained in natural ways. On a theological level, and I can't say this is true, but it's a philosophy of mine, but I can't say it's right, my feeling is that God might do this because it allows people to disbelieve. And if you don't have the ability to disbelieve, then essentially you have no free will. If you have no free will, there's no point to religion whatsoever. I mean, it's my old joke about the Cheerios, right? If God, if you wake up one day, you've heard this story, and I've told this before, and it says in your Cheerios, it says, you know, go to shul, so you can go to shul, but you're not a firm person. I mean, you're following instructions that you couldn't hope to deny even if you wanted to. So that may be the issue. But now I'm already a step beyond recognizing that nature takes part in the miraculous process. I'm already to the point where I'm trying to figure out why God would do that, as opposed to just whatever, you know, do whatever. By all means.
It seems to me that she sees that the kid is dead or like dead.
Right.
And she has a lot of confidence in this nubby. But you don't always want to advertise this, you know, and you don't want to have life go on if he comes and in fact saves the boy, then that's great. And we can either celebrate it or not as the nubby wishes.
Right.
If the nubby either doesn't come,
right,
or can't save the kid,
right,
then it's kind of good not to make a whole hoo-ha over it before, so we don't set up too many expectations and have a great failure.
So she's protecting the honor of the nubby. It's certainly possible. It's certainly possible.
And it could also be that she herself doesn't really believe either that he could be fit, that the child can die.
So why would that cause her to close the door?
She's going to make every effort to save him, but she is not so sure that anybody can.
So by keeping it secret and private,
there's no big expectation.
I see. Low expectations yield high results, essentially, right? Yes, it's certainly possible. There is, of course, another possibility which has to do with the indoor nature of the miracles Elisha performs. His last miracle was done behind closed doors, so she might feel that this one also needs to be done in private behind closed doors. That's a simpler explanation. It backs out of all the stress and tension and just makes it, based on a template. Previous miracle behind closed doors, she probably has heard of this perhaps, or maybe he mentioned the table and she feels, well, this is the way he likes to work, and likes to work. These are all possibilities that simply, mine is much more mundane. Yours is much more effective as trying to get into the psychology of this woman who's clearly a very strong-willed woman. It's all such speculation. We can't know from the text exactly what was driving it, or at least I don't see anything taking us out of the realm of speculation. Again, I think a deeper study of this text and comparing it to other texts in Tanakh there's a lot of comparing this miracle to other miracles, such as Sarah being the template for "I'll come back next year and you'll have a baby." The same words being used here. I think there's some templates going on that Elisha is drawing from previous miracles. I'm thinking that an analysis of those miracles might yield some results, but I haven't done it, so I guess I have to put that on for fun.
In 28, she said, "Did I desire a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me?"
Right.
So it's as though she's not sure that this is really, that he can really save the child, the child that she had not asked.
Right, because instead of saying, "I want you to save the kid," she's saying, "Look what happened, and maybe you have no power to save the kid." Although, the fact that she runs to him, we're going to see another pasuk seems to indicate that she does want to save it. So it's always hard to
save the baby.
It's possible to read the verse that way.
Right.
Yeah.
If it wasn't intended that she should have a kid for all those years, and now he comes up and produces a kid, maybe it wasn't supposed to be
for
a long term.
Yeah.
So all she's doing is yelling at him for essentially setting her up for sorrow, not expecting that he's going to.
Maybe despair.
It's possible.
I'm
not sure if I was supposed to have this kid, but here it is, and now he's dying.
Yeah.
You know, is that the way it's supposed to be? You know, if so, I would have been just as happy without the experience.
Right. Yeah, essentially, just like she didn't request the baby in the first place, she doesn't seem to be forcefully requesting the survival of the baby. And the question is whether that's because low expectations of Elisha's capabilities, or whether that's just a fact of life.
I don't want to talk to him. I want to talk to you, and I want
to
get your little family.
Well, no, but she never says. That she never says.
Well, she says, "I'm not going to leave you."
Yeah.
Oh, no, we'll see. That's after. No, that's different. That's interesting. We'll get to that shortly. That's after he sends Gehazi to do the miracle instead of him. And that's where she flips out.
Yeah.
So we're going to see. So it's not so much, I think it's not so much, that she doesn't say, I'm not going to leave until you perform the miracle. She's saying, I'm not going to leave you until you perform the miracle. So let me read through those verses and see. You know, to give away stuff sort of in advance, there's a lot of Gehazi interference here. We've seen it before. Mm-hmm. Remember in the attic where she's not talking to the woman and Gehazi is going to get her, and this whole rigmarole to make Gehazi the middleman. And we're going to see that idea of Gehazi getting in the middle where I believe he shouldn't is going to be an error on Elisha's part. But it's hard to evaluate these. Anyway, let's read the verses and see where it goes. So in verse 24, she starts her journey to Ish Elohim, and she says, "Vatachavo sha'aton." She gets the donkey all readied up. Vatomer. Yeah, well, that's, you know, yes and no. Chazal make a big deal here. I know what you're thinking. Yeah. Chazal make a big deal by paro. Now, it uses the feminine, and she saddled her donkey. And Chazal make a big deal, if you remember, where Paro was chasing Bnei Yisrael, and he said that he readied his chariot. And they say that's what happens to anger and, a crazy man. Instead of getting his officer to do it, he was so upset he did it himself. And they criticized Paro. Here, there is also Chazal's criticism that instead of her, you know, being calmly get my Narim together, she is such an emotional state that she rushes to do it herself. That's possible in Midrashic. Of course, in the case of a servant-master relationship, very often it says the master does something, and it really means that the master causes it to be done. So when it says that when Paro gets his chariot together, while there's a Midrashic sense that he's doing, you know, he's nodding on the things, it could also easily be interpreted as he told them to go get it, but of course he's given the credit for it because that's just the way it was. So I would pay attention to these things, certainly, but I wouldn't, and Chazal certainly make the comparison between Paro and the woman, not in the sense of good or evil, but the sense of people who just like are so out of control or so flumped that they... What's that? We'll see. She does something. She says, we'll see what she says next. It's very strange. She said to her servant, "Nehag valech, go, go." You know, you get the sense of, you know, really moving. Al tat sorli lirkov. Now I'm going to try to translate this directly, but it's a hard read. Don't stop for me to ride. Ki'im amarti lach, unless I tell you. How to interpret this pasuk is very difficult, and Radak brings back the two possibilities. Either she's walking beside the donkey, that is, don't stop for me to ride, means you ride, I'll run beside you. Although, if she's looking for speed, I don't think that's the way to go. Although, if she's on the donkey, then the nar is next to the donkey, so I guess either way, you're just not moving that fast, and I'm not sure what a donkey does from zero, you know, I'm not sure how fast the donkey moves from 0 to 60, but I'm not sure it ever gets to 0 to 60. So I'm not sure what kind of speed one would expect from a donkey, certainly faster than walking. The other possibility is... What's that?
Back to the donkey.
Yeah, I guess so, with the two of them riding in tandem, perhaps.
Do not
slacken the pace. Do not... Al-tat-sur leader cove, what that means is don't stop, for me, the riding, which means even though we're going to be whipping along and it looks like I'm going to be flying all over the place,
you
keep going. Don't care about whether... Yeah, that's correct. I think that's the better read. That is, the idea that she's walking beside, it probably fits in better with the words, because Al tasur li lirkov, don't stop for me to ride, as in don't stop to pick me up for the ride. Even though that literally is a little tighter with the words, I think your meaning, the meaning that's in your translation is better. That is, don't stop the ride for the sake of me. In which case, the words should really be as follows. Al tasur lirkov, you know, li, or ba'av, really, you wouldn't want li, you want ba'avuri. So the words are a little confusing, and that's why Radak brings down both possibilities. And it could be just her agitation, which causes such a strange speech to take place. Kiyam martila. Pasuk chafei, vatelech vatavo, el ish Elohim, el har kamel. She goes to har kamel, which is really not that far away. Har kamel, of course, by Haifa, the mountain next to Haifa. She's in Shunem, which is the Jezreel Valley. You could do it in a car in an hour and a half or an hour. How long it takes in donkey, I don't know. But theoretically, if she was really moving fast, she probably could have made it within a day.
Well, she could have, you know, gone off the beaten trail.
What's that? She probably went straight as an arrow.
Vayihi
kirot ish Elohim otami neged. So, of course, he's up on a mountain. She can see her coming from a long way away. And by the way, the words vayihi kirot otami neged remind me of Yosef and the Yishmaelim and the Midanim coming down by Hikirotam Meneged. This is one of those things where the Sefer Bereishit in my mind keeps popping up over and over, and I think it demands a more careful study, which I have not done, and I think it will yield some results. So perhaps when I have some free time, I don't know, in 10 or 15 years, I'll do a study of the Sefer Elisha against Sefer Bereishit. I think that I sense there are nuggets to be found in the wash. So in the future time, God willing. Vayhi kirot et ha'ish Elohim otam minegev vayomer gehazi na'aro hinei ha'shunamit halaz. Oh, there's that shunamit. Halaz sometimes is a negative term in Tanakh, like that girl, as in, you know, Clinton type, you know, that girl. But it doesn't, it's sometimes used negatively, but it may just be short for the word zeh, halaz zeh, which really means just this girl. And one should be careful about reading too much into it. I don't see any reason why Elisha would be insulting a woman who was taking care of him so well. Ata roots na, run now, likratav, emorlo hashalom lach, hashalom lishaykh, hashalom liyalet. Everything okay with you and the hubby and the boy?
Wrong question.
And what does she say? Vatomer shalom. Everything is fine. Which is exactly what she said to her husband when the husband said, is everything fine? And she goes, shalom. Which means, it's none of your business to say. I'm not telling you. Now she's not only telling
crazy.
Her husband,
it
what?
It sounds crazy well, that she's saying that now.
I think the clue, though, she's saying it to Gay. That's, I think,
she's
the issue.
Saying it to Gay husband.
I'm talking to Mr. I'm not talking to, and here I think, in a sense, she's more justified than Elisha. Here again, Elisha sends Gehazi to run down off the mountain while he sits down on the mountain. Now, again, I'm sort of giving away too much because we'll see more of this Gehazi interference, but since I've already opened the Pandora's box, I'll keep it up. One could say that, as opposed to Eliyahu, who kept Eliyahu's nar, his servant, was Elisha, who, as far as we could tell, as long as Eliyahu was involved, Elisha got no. He never came in the eighth inning to close up the ball game. Your father says it was Eliyahu. Micha came involved, but as long as Eliyahu was still in business, even though God said Elisha's the man, Elisha doesn't show up until afterwards, and even then he has a hard time getting the job away from Eliyahu. Eliyahu says, don't come with me, and he goes, no, I'm coming with you. He has to really push his way into the action. It could be that Elisha is reacting to this, saying, what I need to do is I need to train a nar. It shouldn't be just a one-man show doing this and that and the other thing. I've got a Navi who's the second in command. I need to prepare him as part of the relationship to do the action. You don't like that idea?
Well, he wasn't. I mean, I don't think Elisha had good judgment.
Well, that's true. So, but here's an interesting thing which Eliyahu Samet says, and I want to... Eliyahu Samet? I always forget Samet's first name. Elkanan Samet says. Elkanan Samet says we tend to character assassinate Gehazi. We know that Gehazi is one of the four non-kings that won't get into Olam Haba. And Gehazi in the next chapter will do some heinous things. So Chazal read back into this chapter all kinds of heinous things which I'll mention in passing, God willing. But Elchanan Samet says, honestly, with a read, without a drashic read of Chazal, Gehazi's just doing what he's told to do. He's not doing anything special. I'll point out a few terrible things that he's accused of doing. But Elchanan Samet says, that's really us reading in Chazal's negative into the words, and one has to read it in. Now, I think that one could actually get a little more. I think there's a little shot to Gehazi's nastiness. However, Elchanan Samet has a point. There's nothing here which overtly says, bad guy. Next chapter we'll get to bad guy. But this chapter there's nothing inherently, so we have to be careful about reading too much in. Right now, he's clearly the second in command. He's Moshe's Yehoshua. He is Eliyahu's Elisha, whoever the Nar was at the time. Perhaps Elisha just thinks he needs to get involved. Because if you don't say that, I'm tempted to say something else, which I'm very uncomfortable saying. It seems to me the only possibility is Elisha's a little egotistical. What, me talk to the woman? I am the big Navi on the mountain.
Well, yeah, but also he's a patrician.
What does that mean, patrician?
He said he's from the upper classes.
Yeah, well, so is she.
No.
That's so he has a sense of, like, hierarchy.
Therefore, you send your servant down to go bring your guest in.
You know, I would say that was very nice, except for when he got his calling to be the Navi, the first thing he does is he takes his 12 bakar, he shechs them, breaks apart all of his wooden equipment, turns them into bowls, and he feeds all of his servants, which was completely unnecessary. It seemed to be sort of a statement that I am now a servant of the people. And it was a powerful statement, I am a servant of the people. I mean, these were his Narim. My dad even, you know, he may have known their names, he was a nice guy. But there was clearly, at that point, a class distinction, which he seems to, in my opinion, the way I'm interpreting that, back in chapter 20, 19, he smashes along with his equipment. And now, you're right, he does, in a sense, seem patristic or whatever it is. So the question is, why would that come back when he made such an effort at not being?
Well, because they're not mutually exclusive. It's one thing to have a regard for the people who serve you with without giving up the relationship of them serving you.
It's sort of like a benevolent monarch type of situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, he could be saying if she's a patrician, then she ought to be treated as
part of a social class. It's possible. I don't know why. I mean, there's no way to prove it one way or the other. But I'd like to give him, you know, down the cup's foot, and assuming that he felt that a Navi is there to not only, maybe I say it because I'm a teacher, the Navi is there not only to be able to show off how smart they are, but also to train the next generation of people to be able to train their next generation of people. And I think that's a more positive outlook, which of course avoids the social class distinctions. I'm simply more comfortable with it because I'd like to, I'm not one to say that everybody who shows up in Tanakh is a tzaddik. And therefore, since I am believe that we're here to find flaws in our tzaddikim, it's also careful, I also try to be careful not to find too many flaws. So in this case, I'd like to read in that this is a part of an educational process which is misguided, although whether it's misguided because it's bad to get somebody else to get involved and teach the next person to do the job, or whether because you just picked a guy like Gehazi who should have recognized was a bad guy, as we'll see in the next chapter, I don't know. I mean, you know, that question happens in hospitals, right? In training hospitals. So, you know, the process comes and the doctor doesn't do it, but the intern or they got it. And everybody, you know, is like, no, not on me, right? And it's a NIMBY situation, right? Not in my backyard. Very good. They go, that resident really needs to be trained. But on the next guy, you know, the guy without the means, I'll slip you a 50. I don't really know. I don't think you can do such a thing. But I think there's a sense that if you have a serious procedure,
especially
you don't want somebody. What's that?
Especially
I think there's something to that. But so on one hand, you want the best serving you for the, you know, when you really need it. On the other hand, you got to learn. Somebody's got to learn. So it's not. So I'm caught between these two views of. I'm caught between these two problems. But the one thing that is clear is that it is a problem that Gehazi is getting in the way, and we'll see that more and more. So let's go back to verse. And her statement, which I think is powerful, is I'm not talking to Gehazi. Gehazi, you want to know what the problem is? Everything is fine. Let's move right along. Vatavo el Ish Elohim el Ahar, vatachzeik beraglav. She grabs his feet. Vayigash Gehazi lohodfa, and Gehazi comes to push her away. Vayomer Ish Elohim harpela, let her go. Ki nafsha marala, because her soul is bitter. Vadanai halim mimeni, but God is hidden from me, velo higidli, and he did not tell me. So there's what Chazal do to Gehazi here, that there's a sexual element, that he attacks her sexually, all kinds of strength. Chazal do a character assassination here, that Gehazi grabbing this woman, you know, everybody was Nigi, but I mean they really play it up and they feel that he was doing an evil thing. But again, we have a situation where if we remove that character assassination, the expectation is one does not grab the legs of the Navi, and Gehazi is trained to think that, so therefore he says separate them, and even Elisha seems to agree with that, except for the fact that something is clearly, she's clearly in this super difficult situation, and therefore she needs to be understood and allowed to grab onto the Navi's legs. Radak once again has it both ways in this case. He says, on one hand, Gehazi moves away because it wasn't honor and respect for the woman to be grabbing onto somebody's legs and kicking them since she was an Isha Gdolah. And then Radak gives the other possibility, which is that it was not kavod for the Navi. So again, Radak is sort of, he could play it both ways. It's not, it's a little unclear whose emotions are being hurt here, who's being respected, and why this action is taking place. But I would say I like the second opinion, which is that the expectation that Gehazi has been set up with is that you must go to the middleman. Remember, they're in the attic, and Eliyahu's not talking to her, he's talking to Gehazi, and Gehazi's talking to the woman, and the woman's like, hey, I'm, you know, talking to you, buddy, let's have this conversation. This was last week's stuff, I apologize. One of the times that I leave things for two times. But certainly, I think Gehazi's expectation is nobody talking to the king. You want to talk to him, talk to me. And to the point where he's willing to grab her and remove her from grabbing onto the Navi. There's recollections here, by the way, of the Chana story. nafshav hi maralav ubachotiv keh, and the navi cannot see what's bothering her, right? That in the case of Eli, Eli does not see what's bothering her, although in this case he outdoes Eli, because he recognizes that vision has been taken away from him, and therefore he realizes he has to pursue further, as opposed to Eli, who did not have vision, but didn't recognize that it was his fault he didn't recognize that it was his fault. Here, Elisha recognizes that God is not speaking to me and we got a problem, so I better go beyond the normal letter of the law. So again, you have this comparison to an older story. There are so many motifs here of older stories in Tanakh that again, I think that a diligent study is worthwhile. Pasuk Chav Chet, Vatomer Hasha'alta Ven Me'et Adoni, Halo Amarti Lo Tashle'oti. I told you not to trick me, not to cheat me. Mm-hmm. What are you doing? And what's also, as she points out, she never asked for the baby in the first place. Mm-hmm. As if I asked for it and you gave me a baby, then I guess all I could expect was a response to my prayer. But if you're the one who went out of the way to give it to me, why would you give it and then take it away?
What does Tishle mean?
She does.
But Tishle is a difficult word. The easiest thing is just to match it to the word that she said before. When he said you're having a baby, she said, Al techazev bi, don't trick me or don't cheat me. So the easiest thing is to match up those two things. Shol tasholu could be the idea of to charge me interest, so to speak. I think the idea is to treat me wrongly in one way or the other. I think Radak brings down the word shkaga, don't cause me to be mistaken, like when you do something with shogi, don't trick me or don't cause me to be in error. So it's a difficult word. How does the English do al tashlauti? Don't what?
Do not deceive.
Deceive me, which is like techazev.
Yeah,
that's yeah, which I assume is the same word that she. And now tell me, if you would, what the last word is, the translation for techazev in verse 16. Yeah, I think it's all. I would imagine the same word in verse 17. What in verse 16? What do you have? Don't blank to your handmaiden.
Lie.
Don't lie. Okay, so you know what happened. The translation. There's not much difference. So the translation found two different Hebrew words, so it used two different synonymous English words. There may be more going on, but I think that's a fair translation. Verse 29. Vayomer l'Gehazi. So again, we have Gehazi in Torah. Vayomer l'Gehazi. He says to Gehazi, Chagor motnecha. Put on your belt, you know, get your stuff ready. V'kach mishanti biyadecha. And take my staff in your hand. And this is also why I lean to the idea that I want you to perform a miracle with my staff. I'm into the idea of like a training, teaching thing, even though it could be my own bias. Velech and go, ki timsal ish lo tivarchenu. If you find a man, do not say shalom to him. Vechi yivarech chayish, if somebody says shalom alecha, lo tanenu, do not say aleichem shalom back. Vesamta mishanti al pnei anar. Put the mishenet on the nar. Now he never says what's going to happen, but that's sort of classic Elisha, because that was the same thing with the woman with the pots. All he told the woman to do is go get pots from everybody and make sure they're under the pot that's flowing. He never really says what's going to happen. He never says what's supposed to happen. The assumption here is that if Gehazi, there may be other ways to read this, but I think the simple explanation is he's saying, go, put the staff on the child, and the child will come back to life. One could expect a miracle, even though it's not explicitly stated.
She doesn't explicitly tell him what's wrong, does she?
No.
I'm missing.
For her to be so distraught.
Yeah, but it's sort of unclear what. I guess so. Yeah.
Oh, I would think she thinks that the child is dead.
No,
I mean,
she may, but she doesn't tell him. She doesn't spell out from. I mean, you don't really know. You know something's wrong, but. He doesn't have to know.
Yeah, but he knows it
because he's a
novice.
I don't know
if she grabs him around the legs and she's got to be crying distraught. I can't imagine him just being standard sick.
Be on his deathbed, you know.
You mean dying but not dead?
Yeah. So he can read this as the kid is dying. She's coming there and saying, "What did you do? You mm-hmm. gave me the child.
Yeah,
but I didn't
ask." I'll tell you why.
I think that's exactly the problem.
That's why I'm going to reinforce that the child is dead for two reasons. First of all, the word shol tasholu is usually used when somebody lends money and then takes back plus. That's the idea of lo tasholu. That is, it's the idea of a money lender that gives and then takes back. We say, don't take back the cloak that somebody wears because he needs to have the cloak. You'll have to give him a loan or whatever it is. That's the word tashol. Tashol generally means don't give it and don't take it, you know, don't lend something and then by taking it back cause a bad situation. So that's the, I believe that's the Torah word, and therefore I think the idea is why did you give him why and then took back like some kind of money collector. And I think it's hard, now you don't have to, obviously the Englishes are not agreeing with me. The Englishes are just saying, you know, why'd you trick me? But I know what the, I'm pretty sure I know what that word shol means from I think it's a ki tavo, or somebody in that area in Devarim.
The root of shalal, you saying? Monetary?
I think shalal means sort of to
monetary.
Take back. I think tasholu means to take back what's been given. And this guy, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I'm sorry, I should have done the research, I'll do it next time. I think lo tasholu with the beggar means, like if you lend somebody a cloak to wear, you're not allowed to take it back because our Rome, because he'll be poor, and he'll cry out to God, and God will listen because he's poor. I think that's where the word comes from. So I have a hard time believing here that she doesn't know. But also, I want to emphasize that emphasizes the mistake that Elise is making. Elisha's really been, Gehazi is the guy you're going to be talking to. He's the guy. And here, Elisha may be making a mistake. When the going gets tough, you get going. You can't send the resident to do this job. And I think that's what the next pasuk is. I think that's the direct criticism that she gives him. And I'm going to read those words. And you'll see what I'm going to reinforce that with the next pasuk. I'll show you why. Vatomer im hana'ara, chai Adonai, I swear to God and I swear on your life that I will not leave you. And then he gets up to go after her, which makes no sense because the simple meaning of I won't leave you is Gehazi will go and do the stuff and I'm going to stay here right by your feet until I know what's going on. But clearly what that means is im ezveka, that as she makes this swear, and based on this swear, he gets up and goes to do the yell at himself. So what was it in her adjurement of him? What was it in her swearing him to something that caused him to get up and do the miracle himself? And what I'd like to say is, remember the last person who said, Chei Hashem v'chei nafshecha im ezveka, was none other than Elisha himself. When was it? Eliyahu was going away from the whole world. He says, I'm going to Beit El. You stay here. Now, you don't do the job. You stay out of it. I'm going to take care of it. And Elisha says, Chei nafsh, in those same words, Chei Hashem, Chei nafshecha im ezveka, I'm not leaving you. I'm involved in this process. So I think by using his words back on him, because he must be famous for that, or I think he would, she says, remember, Chei nafsh, I mean, that's got a ring bell. So when you say Chei nafshecha im, Chei Hashem, im ezveka, and that's the same words that he told Elisha when he told Eliyahu that he would not back down and that he was going to go through the process and the miracles and he was going to see whether God was with him himself. I think that she's saying that and that causes him to jump up and run to do the miracle himself. That's how he is. Otherwise, it's impossible to tell why she's saying, I swear I'm going to stay with you in Har Carmel, makes him get up. I guess if we wanted to be more simplistic, it's like he didn't want her around, so he figured he'd try somewhere else. You know, she's staying here, I'm going somewhere else. But obviously, I don't think there's any justification for reading that.
I think it's you know, if she's going to hang out with him, he's not going to be able to do anything else.
So he's got to go do the miracle anyway.
Make sure that it's all taken care of.
Right, and that's why I think it. I think that there's a much bigger matter. The fact that
she's just saying to him that no, I'm not going to go with Gehazi. I want your attention.
Well, I want you to go. Exactly right.
Yeah.
So which means she's not just saying, I'm going to not leave you as in, I'm going to stay with you in Har Carmel. She's saying, I'm not going to leave you until you go and do the miracle, which is why he gets up and does the miracle. Exactly right. But that means she's giving him Musa Shmuz. That means that, in her opinion, she's giving him a Musa Shmuz. You think you can get away with this with your resident? It ain't happening. You're going to get up and you're going to go and you're going to take care of the yell like you said.
I don't know that it's a Musa, or it just might be their relationship. You know, they were not exactly strangers.
That's correct. Well, whether she felt that she personally was judged, you could say she personally felt that she had done for him, she justified work by the doctor and not by the resident. I'm looking at something more global here, at an overall criticism against Elisha for getting other people involved when he should be involved. But of course I'm cheating, because I know in the next chapter that Elisha is going to send Gehazi to do a very important mission, and because he messes it up because of greed, it's going to cause years of warfare. So I, you know, again, I'm telling you that this will not be the last time that apparently Elisha makes this mistake. Now the question is, why would Elisha write about himself making all these mistakes? Because Elisha definitely seems to be the author here. The king is not involved. You can't say this comes from king archives. This comes purely from the school of the prophets. So somebody is criticizing Elisha. Why would you criticize Elisha if he is the main prophet? And I think that there may be a criticism here. Hard to say. I don't know. Why would you be criticizing him? To show maybe that even prophets, not just kings need to be beaten up on sometimes, but even prophets need to be instructed to make sure they're doing the job right. I don't know. I'm making assessments about the parsha. All I can tell you is I see what's happening, which is Elisha is getting people involved. He's being criticized for it. And in the end, things only work out when he gets involved himself. And yet I don't understand what the moral message is. I don't understand why Elisha would have made such a mistake. And if he does make such a mistake, why that's worthy of writing down in a book of Kings.
Why isn't there a rabbinic literature on this? Well, if it's more of a Chumash, you'd have hundreds of commentaries on every word.
Well, there is. There is a lot about how Gehazi, remember he told Gehazi not to speak to everybody on the way? So Chazal say what happened was that he stopped to speak to everybody. And he stopped, he said, see the staff? Elisha thinks I'm going to do a miracle with this. Ha, ha, ha. So they really bean him. The reason why we're doing this is because I'm doing something, I'm not making something up, of course. This dates back to Menachem before him, Yoel Ben Nun, and then the other leaders of the rebirth of Tanakh scholarship in the 20th century, which is to use the fields of psychology, human interest, to see... You know, you read books like Gretz. I think he's up here on the wall somewhere. The history of the Jewish people. Orthodox Jews do not like Mr. Gretz at all. And he felt, but one of the big mistakes that was made during the 1800s, and it was made by Gretz, Wellhausen, and others, was that human beings, just like they technologically evolved into this century, they also spiritually evolved. That is, back then, the reason why they had these religions is because they were very base people. They had not evolved. People were really into Darwinism, and they really felt that over the course of 3,000 years, 4,000 years, that people were... spiritually primitives, and therefore the religion reflected the spirituality. Thank God we dug up a lot of stones and material, and we see that they were just as complex as we are, and we notice that we're sometimes just as uncomplex as and primitive as they are. The doming of what happened today with the mosque and stuff like that. Wow. I mean, I don't know if we're all that. I don't know if Gretz, they're part of that German kind of we are better than anybody who's come before. But now I think there's a recognition that psychology of today does apply to 3,000 years ago, that spirituality does apply. So the question is, now that we've seen them as great human beings, but human beings nonetheless, it allows a slightly different analysis that I'm doing, which was simply not, Rashi, Chazal, remember with David's son, Avshalom, who's this terrible guy who tried to kill his father, but he's growing long hair because he's a Nazir and he's going to do his mitzvot. Why would a guy who's willing to kill all of his brothers worry about whether he's doing the right korban for, Nazir? Seems strange, right? I break Shabbat, but I worry about whether, it's just a weird, but there was this sense back then to, unless the Torah didn't specifically say they were sinners, they were, pure in every way. And I think we've come away from that to a certain extent. We may be wrong, we may be right, but that's the framework that I'm doing it in, and therefore that the analysis is affected, which is why you only have this kind of literature over the last, I'd say, 100 years.
Then you have problems interpreting the text if you're doing it.
They had problems interpreting it. All of us are inserting things in.
You're not.
Nah, they created things in between the lines to explain stuff. Gehazi, stopping and talking to people. I'm trying not to put anything in the lines. I'm trying to understand what's going on in the minds of the people to cause them to do the things that we're trying to do. But I could just be trying to give myself a better reputation than I really deserve. You're right. Look, any exegesis, which means any attempt to know what's going on in the text, always involves a certain amount of eisegesis, of putting back into the text. Everybody opens Tanakh and reads in what they want to read. You hope that a good exegete tries to be as honest as possible to the text without reading too much stuff in. But once you sort of make a decision on where you think 80% of the text is going, so you take a good shovel and you shovel it into the 20% that you can make work out. And that's it always works. It's always been like that with every parshan. It's just the way it goes. And I'm not sure I rate the word parshan or exegete, but I think that there's something to that. But anyway, let's see if we can finish the story. We just have a few minutes left. So he gets up and he does the work himself. So the Gehazi Avar, so now it's interesting, by the way, it's beautiful stuff. Adele Berlin, who teaches Bible in Maryland is very good with this, where she notices the camera. Some people think that the narrative of Bible is very primitive, and that was an idea also during Germany's in the 1800s. But here she emphasizes these things where the narrative of the Bible is beautiful. The camera switches. Like you see Gehazi. So you're on the mountain. Gehazi is left, but you don't know what's happened to him. And then what you do is she got this emotional state, and then you see them walk off into the distance, and then the camera switches to the scene of the crime, if you will, where Gehazi is going, "I can't get it to work. It won't work for me." And then just as he's about to give up all hope, in comes Elisha with the thing. It's really very effective. If you put a camera, you know, you can see the shifting cameras, and it's a very, very nice, play. But you have to watch carefully the verbs. They're used in such a way to show you that the camera switches. And she's very big. If you want to, I don't agree with everything she has to say, but she really reads a lot of beauty into it. Not even read, she recognized a lot of beauty in the narrative, that it's in some ways complex. 31. So here's the one argument about the coma thing. He hears nothing. No heartbeat, no noise, no breathing, no nothing. Now, he could be in a deep state, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah, but it's already dead.
What?
It says the kid was dead.
Well, no, it just says...
He was not awakened.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, but when Elisha comes in, behold, the child is dead.
Yeah, of course, the word may could be dying, it could be the state. I could say, you know, that person's dead, but I don't... The word dead is stative, which means it could be a process of something going on. He's dying. That's why Vayarotan Meit al Sfatayam. There are two ways to interpret that. The interpreters go two ways. Either they saw the Egyptians dead on the water, or they saw them dying on the water, and that's where Rashi goes. So the word mate, because it's a state of verb, it describes a state of being, and that's the ability of describing something that's really already there, something that happened right now. Who mate? He just died? Or who mate? He's in the process of dying. I'm getting into grammar land, and it's a little too deep for now, but the word mate does have a little flexibility. Vayavo Elisha Baita, so he comes into the house.
Avar Lefneihem means he left before them?
Yeah, it means he had crossed before them, which means he had...
They're not,
he was ahead of them, essentially.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean he crossed, he ran past them.
It's not a state of thing.
No, he had gone, past tense. Avar Lefneihem, yeah. Avar. He had already gone. Yeah. Vayavo Elisha Baita Bnei Anar Meit. All right, so essentially it does seem to describe that he's dead, not dying. So I think you're right, Anne. Mushkav Al Mitato, he's laying on the bed. Vayavo Vayizkor Adel Bajnam, so he closes the door behind both them. Again, this sort of classic Elisha, all miracles kind of like in private in a sense. Vayipalel Adonai, he prays to God. Vayal Vayishkav La Yelet, so he lays down. Now what Radak would say is this was happening at the same time. He was Yitpalel El Hashem, and how was he Yitpalel El Hashem? Yitpalel El Hashem by spreading him out. Or, you could see it sequentially. First he prayed, and after doing that part of the duty, then he tried blowing into his mouth. What's that? Yes, correct. Vayal Vayishkav La Yelet, Vayasim Pivo Pivi, Navanav, Eye to Eye, Mouth to Mouth, Kapav Kapav, hands to hands, Vayigarla, Vayakam, sorry, Yelet, he got warm. Now something else weird happens, and I don't know what to tell you what it means. Vayasha Vayelach Babayet Achad. So he goes back, and he goes one house distance in one way. That is, he leaves the boy, Hena, Vayachad Hena, Vayal Vayagarla, and then he goes back up. Like there's a time interval. He takes a small walk around the block, and then he goes up for another breathing incident. Vayizorer Hanar. Now, Yizorer, I think he means, either means he simply moved, or I think it means he may have sneezed, or like sort of gave a, again, like what you'd expect from CPR, you know, that kind of coughing type of thing. Ad Sheva Pamim, it happened seven times. Vayivkach Hanar Etinav, and the boy opens up in his eyes. Vayikral Gehazi Vayomer, Kral Shunamit Azot. So here again, instead of calling to the Shunamit, he tells Gehazi to call to the Shunamit. It's very strange. It's as if he's not learning. Vayikra'eha, and they called to her, Vatavoila, Vayomer, Si'ivinech, take your boy, Vatavo, and she comes, Vatipo, Aragrav, Vatishtacha, once again she falls on the ground by his feet, Arza, Vatisa, Ebna, Vatetse, and she takes the child, and she leaves. It's 9 o'clock, but if you...
Wait, she takes the
child,
and she leaves, but that's her house.
She leaves the attic, that's good, so Radak says she leaves the attic, she leaves his room. Although there's more to it than that. There's a lot of yetzes, yelechs, yetzes. A lot of the word yetzes shows up a lot here. So there's something going on there as well. There's a lot of double words. Vayelech, vayetze, vayetze, vayiga, lech, vakach. There's a lot of these double verbs. And here again we have sort of a tisa, vatetze. She picks him up and she goes. there's something going on here that I don't understand, but I can't ignore it. There's something about these all these double verbs in the word yetzeh that comes up a lot, and the running and the jumping and the moving. It's a very vigorous
parsha.
They do, so I'm not sure what it's trying to tell us here, but there's so many of them. I don't think that they could be. Yeah, but now she's moving fast. Why? I mean, why is she jumping out of the room?
Yeah, you would think they would mention that she thanked him.
Yeah, but again, she didn't thank him on the first time. She's not thanking him on the second time. So the whole thing leaves us through.
She
bows, she falls at his feet. Yeah, well, that's true. Tishtaku, although never, you know.
And then she takes her son and leaves.
As if he told her to take him and leave, and she bows first, and then she goes. That's a nice insight, actually. So she's actually saying to him, no, I need to thank you. As if, what, he doesn't want to thank you? Does he not want to thank you? Does he not feel he needs it or deserves it? Is he just fixing something that shouldn't have been broken in the first place? And how does Elisha feel all about this? How does Elisha, why didn't God tell Elisha what happened? Why does Elisha think that God doesn't tell him what happened? And why would God take away the gift that Elisha gave? Was it because Elisha gave it and forced God to give the gift? I understand these parshas not.
If God would have taken it away, he wouldn't have given it back.
That's right.
Correct. You're right.
Or maybe to test Elisha.
I said
as well as the woman.
You're right, and that's where Elchanan Samet says it's a criticism against Elisha, because with all the other miraculous births we've ever had in Tanakh, the Navi was always instinctively involved in raising the kid to greatness, and yet the father doesn't care that much about the son. He doesn't really know whether he's alive or dead.
But
well, yeah, but Yitzchak and Yaakov, there's a certain, you know, Avram and Yitzchak. I mean, you don't.
He's an itinerant. You got a whole series of these things moving along.
Who, the father?
Elisha.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in this case, he seems to be static, but you're right. Maybe Elisha's running around so much helping people, he doesn't have time for anyone. Boy, I must be honest. I understand the words. I think I can get a basic idea of what's going on. I see a problem with Elisha and Gehazi. There are things going on in this parsha. There are moral lessons to be learned, which are I don't understand. Maybe God willing, I apologize. God willing, next time I think I'll put the kind of time and effort that it requires to eke out the secrets in this parsha. Because most of the time I get the sense that I have a basic idea of what's going on. Here I think I know maybe 20 or 30% of what's happening in this parsha. What's that?
They're
criticizing Gehazi.
Where are they
Midrash? Midrash Buber Tanchuma. You got a lot of it in Bereishit Rabbah. Because whenever the stories connect with what's going on by Sarah and other connections, so that's where it comes in. And there's a Gemara also in Tanit, I think, which has like a full page on this stuff, mostly condemning, you know, Gehazi and talking about.
Not here, one spot. You got to go elsewhere.
That's correct. Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. I just want to take you to one short thing to show you that the woman is not out of the picture. If you take a look at chapter eight. Verse 1, and something strange happens. We have a recurring character.
Oh, yeah.
This is after a terrible famine.
Elisha.
Viber Elisha. Elisha speaks to the woman, Asher Hechayat Banale Mor, who he resurrected her child, saying, Kumi uluchi atu veitech veguri basher daguri. Get out of Israel. Leave. Kikara Adonai Larav, because God has decided there's going to be a famine. That's what Kara means here. V'gam ba'al aret sheva shanim. There's going to be a famine for 7 years. So essentially, he gives her an inside tip. It's like a stock market tip. Sell land now. You know, get it. But she doesn't sell land because she can't really. So he listens to her. She goes with her house. Another one of those proofs. I'm sorry to say that Eretz Plishtim, the Gaza Strip, was never under Israeli rule, even during the best of times. Here's another example where Eretz Plishtim is simply outside the jurisdiction of northern and southern Israel. So at the end of 7 years, she comes back because the famine's over. And she goes to yell at the king of